Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmakers Show. So today we have a really amazing founder, you know, a founder that has built a massive company. I mean, we're talking about a company with over 2,700 people. So you can do the math, you know, on the level of impact that they've had. And we're going to be talking about how to think about opportunity, how to talk out to your customers to be able to get it right when it comes to the product, going through the experience of an accelerator, as well as getting going on startup fundraising, which is one of the things that you need to do as a founder of a hypergrowth company. And then also feeling the pressure to expand product, amongst many other things. But really brace yourself for a very inspiring conversation. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Tomer London. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Excited to be here.
So originally born in, and you grew up as well in Israel. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Yeah, totally. So yeah, grew up in Haifa in Israel. I grew up around a lot of small businesses. So my dad has a small business for over 35 years now, a clothing store. So for me it was, just a big part of my childhood going after school and helping around, and whether it's, helping clean the store or answer phone calls or, selling and learning how to sell, like kind of, that was a huge part of my childhood. And then, for a small business family also, that's what you talk about at the dinner table. You talk about the customers, you talk about the vendors, talk about how things are going. And then finally, there's also like the non-glamorous parts and the parts that kind of make you, kind of really appreciate the hard work that goes into building a small business. I remember my dad kind of needing to skip different, family events and things like that, just dinners, things like that, to just go and to this back room that we had in the house with this calculator. If you remember the ones with the ribbons in the back, that's kind of like, and he was like, needed to spend hours and hours and hours to close the week and see if the cash flow and understand whether, where the business was. So, my childhood was a lot around kind of that kind of small business and stress, as well as the wonderful things coming from building, building your own dream and making it a reality. And that's just my dad. I also had my grandfather and my aunt headed up different small businesses. So, honestly, that was kind of all around me.
So what was it like to see your parents perhaps going through the roller coaster of emotions of being a business owner?
Yeah, it's the emotional piece that really stuck with me. That's kind of what with the memory. So these are things such as, seeing my dad coming in the house like at the end of the day and like kind of see like this bright, kind of face and like a big, big smile. And, this was a good day today, good day of work. And, he would be really quick to share like the revenue for today or to share the big win. It could be like, getting, renewing his rent with like a lower price. So it make the business more profitable. Could be having a new employee joining and that really proud and excited about the work of that employee. But then there's also the negative kind of emotions where, there's just stress of like, oh my God, there's all these loans that I need to repay. And that there's like a holiday that this calendar year means that there's more days in the more days of, holidays, people have more time off and we're going to get less customers. And so that's totally just kind of a part of what it means. And definitely struck with me. I remember, kind of thinking to myself, about different career paths and things like that. And I felt like, for me, like running a small business like that seems really, really, really hard. And I kind of got closer and closer to software when I was, I think, in my teens, early teens. And it was actually to build software to help in the store. So I had all these lists to keep track of the inventory of the store and to see what we need to order. So it could be, this was a men's clothing store. So is it like jeans? Which jeans are missing for which size, for which model? Is it suits? Is it shoes and all that stuff? And, if you keep losing, I kept losing my list. I needed to recount things. So that's obviously, a waste of time. I was very frustrated. So and I was thinking, computers are really good at this stuff, remembering things, right? We have a 83, 86 at home. And I was lucky enough to get introduced to Visual Basic, which is a very simple programming language, really, really easy for a kid to learn, by the bookstore that was just next to my dad's store, actually. So I picked up this book, this really big, thick book. It was all in Hebrew, which was good for me because I didn't have English back then. And I kind of learned how to build a simple program. And I built like this very, very simple inventory management program that was super helpful. And you know, my dad bought a small PC to his store as a result. And for me as a kid, you know, I was like, I don't know, 11, 12. My mind was blown, like, wait, like you're buying a PC just for this software? That's like, you know, I felt like I was really kind of making an impact. And it's funny how those things go, but you know, looking backwards, like, oh, look at that. Tomer at the age of 12 was already building small business software. But you know, sometimes life, you know, kind of, you know, obviously there was a lot of ups and downs and I did a lot of other things. But sometimes it's funny how kind of, you know, you kind of close the circle. And for me, small businesses is just honest. And for Josh and Eddie, who started the company with me, and many of people who work in Gusto, we love small businesses and we have this kind of direct connection to them.
I mean, in your case, you know, as you were saying, you got exposed to programming, you know, very early when you were actually at the store with your parents. And then from there, you know, you actually went to the military. You know, I want to ask you here, what kind of discipline do you think it gave you, you know, those 3 years that you spent in the military in Israel?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. So in Israel, there's a 3 years mandatory service for men. Back then when I was there, it was 2 years for women, 3 years for men. And they basically kind of put you wherever they want. So you have some say on which unit to go to, but it's the military's decision. And I really wanted to go to the, you know, the software kind of computer engineering sort of units, where Israel is, they have really kind of amazing units around that. They can learn a lot and develop their skills and do things that are meaningful. But they didn't pick me. And I ended up, they put me in a combat unit, which in the Air Force, which was not my pick, was not number even 17 on my list, you know? So that right there for me was a big learning of just like, you know, humility and how to deal with things that are not in your control. You know, I think up to that point, you know, I did well in school and I felt like I was in control of my life and like, you know, doing homework and, you know, doing different projects and things like that. I was always ahead. I was two steps ahead. And then over all of a sudden, like you kind of get a big, like kind of slap in the face, like, hey, it's all cute and nice, but in the next 3 years, you're going to do this thing. And this thing is nothing like you've ever done before. And it's actually quite difficult. So that was one huge learning, humility. And I kept getting that slap in the face every few months in my military service because, you know, I would say military, at least the Israeli military, you know, they have, you know, it's not a creative effort. It's not a creative, sort of project. Like you go there and you have a role and you need to do your job and there's not a lot of what you can do around it. You kind of need to do what you're told, at least when you're very junior, which, you know, I was, that was really hard for me. But I'll tell you what, like at the end of it, like in the last few months of my service, I was so full of excitement and energy towards the next step, which was for me going to the Technion and learning, studying electrical engineering. I just could not put down like calculus books and physics books. And like the kind of first couple of semesters, I was already swimming and ready to jump in. Because I think I gained appreciation for how lucky it is to be in a place where you can go and study in an undergrad degree and really kind of pave your own path. And the military, again, for 3 years, 18 to 21, you kind of need to do what you're told and obviously, you know, do the best you can with that. You know, I was very excited about that next thing. I'll say one last thing, which is camaraderie is one thing that I think I really took from it. So this amazing, there is an amazing experience of like when you and a group of other people come together and you have a shared destiny where, you know, it's either you do it together and you win together or you lose together. Like it's up to us to get together and figure this thing out. And this thing may be really, really complicated, can be really dangerous, can be, you know, something that you never thought you'll have to do. And when you look back, like that camaraderie is just so amazing. It's a tight human relationship that even today, 20 years later, you know, I feel so close to these people that I was in service with. And I think there's some commonality with startups.
100%. Now, talking about startups, I mean, after this, You did electrical engineering, then you did a bunch of internships, and then you build your first startup. And as they say, you either succeed or you learn. And in this case, there was a lot of lessons learned. So what happened there?
Yeah, totally. That's a good way of saying it. So here's the thing. I, like any normal adult, I had to have all these calls to service centers as a part of my life. It could be calling your cellular phone provider. It could be calling your doctor or the hospital or something like that, right? And then when you call in, it's just this extremely annoying thing where you got to wait and you have this IVR that speaks to you slowly and tells you, if you want this, go to option number one. Please listen carefully because our menu has changed, you know? And you kind of need to go. And I was like, God damn it. Like, we got it. There has to be a better way. And I remember thinking, like, at this moment, right now, this second, there's millions of people who are doing nothing but just waiting for that freaking IVR to finish, you know, that voice menu. So that was like the pain point. And, you know, back then, this is 2008 or 2007. Back then, you know, the iPhone was super, super early. I don't even remember if it was launched back then. But everyone had a feature phone. And these are phones that, these Nokia phones that had, or Samsung phones or Blackberries, that had like an internet connection. So you had this really kind of simple WAP internet. And I was thinking, hey, would it be cool if you call one of these centers, but instead of waiting on the line, you can just visually see all these menus and can navigate yourself and even self-serve without talking with somebody? That sounded cool. So I got together with a few friends. We were doing our degree in electrical engineering. I quit my job. I had like a part-time job at Intel, which was also really fun, but another topic for another day. And I quit that job to start this thing with a few friends. And we built the technology, and it was actually quite cool. It was, I'm still today pretty proud of the kind of the way it was built, because technically it was multiple technical challenges that were difficult, because you didn't need to install an app. There's no app installed. You just call, boom, you get a menu on your screen. So the technology was like, okay, product technology, you got a good prototype, things looked good. We felt good. We raised a little bit of money, like seed from you know, government and from some friends. And then we went out to do the selling. How hard could that be? The technology is amazing. The product is amazing. Everyone's just going to gobble it all up. Well, unfortunately, no one bought it. Unfortunately, we spent months and months on kind of trying to figure out go to market. How do you sell? You know, I knew how to sell clothes in a clothing store. I knew how to sell, you know, maybe like kind of simple things. They did like some door-to-door sales for like internet. Like a high bandwidth internet and things like that. But I didn't know how to sell for like huge enterprises with like hundreds of millions of dollars of budget. And I failed there. And as a result, like we kind of got stuck. We got some LOIs. We got some even like some you know, early pilots going on, but we didn't really do the sale. So that's where we got stuck. And, you know, lots of learnings from this. But, you know, I would say the primary one is when you build a plan and, you know, try to figure out how the startup is going to work. Obviously, the product and technology are critical, but if you have that and you have no go-to-market, you're dead.
I hear you. Now, in your case, you know, one door closes, another one opens. And for you, the next door was to go to Stanford to get your PhD. And that was a pivotal moment, because that is the moment where you really got going with your co-founders at Gusto. So, how did that happen? How did the, you know, the band, you know, come together?
Well, first, here's a funny story. I thought that Stanford was in England. I learned about Stanford because of this amazing commencement speech that Steve Jobs did in 2005. Incredibly inspiring. If you haven't heard it, you should. I listened to it probably dozens of times at this point, where he talks about, you know, your ability as an entrepreneur and as a human being to make a difference in the world. I was, you know, incredibly inspired by it. And it was done at Stanford. I was like, wait, where's the Stanford place? I heard of Harvard and MIT from movies, right? But I never heard of Stanford. So anyway, apparently Stanford, in spite of the name that feels like it's from England, it's actually in Silicon Valley. And I heard of Silicon Valley and I kind of got into it a little bit more. A friend of mine ended up actually going there. Decided to apply, and there was kind of landing in San Francisco and then going to Stanford for my electrical engineering PhD. And I didn't know anybody. I was literally came on my own. You know, I had one friend who was actually on vacation when I landed, so he was not there. And I was literally just trying to figure out how am I going to find some friends and, you know, find a community. So there's a lot of things that I did. And one of them was to apply to this cool program that Stanford has called Stanford Alumni Mentorship Program that connects current students with prior students. And that's how I got to know Josh, who's around my same age. And, you know, we kind of learned that we met through that, which is cool. We learned that both of us have startup experiences. He had a startup previously. I had a startup. We're both electrical engineering graduates, and that's kind of how we got together. And, you know, we then started spending time every week to just brainstorm ideas, you know, like things we care about, problems we see in the world, areas where we think technology can help. Over time also, we brought in Eddie, my third co-founder, still kind of kept brainstorming ideas and things like that. And we ended up, looking at multiple different areas. But the area that kind of kept coming back and stuck with us is how can we help small businesses succeed? Because, you know, our personal lives, we had small businesses and our families and so forth and friends. And we felt like there's so many software brands that are focused on consumers. There's so many software brands that are focused on enterprise, but not many focused on small businesses. And they have lots of problems. And it's a huge market. There's 6 million employers in the U.S. And when you talk with them, they got a lot of problems to solve. So we kind of jumped on that, and payroll was our first. Really started with payroll as the first pain point.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So how do you go about then speaking with tons of small businesses to make sure that you would get the product right before even touching the product? Because I think that one of the issues that I see all the time is that founders build on assumptions, you know, instead of building based on data points that they're able to capture. And that's where many of them fail. But it sounds like you guys got that right. So how did you think about like, hey, maybe, you know, we should have a chat with all these small business owners to really understand well the product before we even build it?
The cool thing is when you talk with a lot of your customers, potential customers, and you talk with like 10, 20, 50, 100, and you talk with them about their day, you talk with them about the problems that they're seeing, what ends up happening, it's not just data points. You build intuition. Your brain connects the dots. So then a week later, a month, a year later, when you're in front of a problem trying to solve for them, you can bring up that intuition, and that intuition will be probably more correct than not. So what we do even today at Gusto is trying to make sure that everyone who builds a product, definitely the product management team, the design team, but also other folks on the team, marketers for sure, guys, just spend time with customers and build that intuition. So you're right. Like I think one mistake people make is to just completely rely on their intuition without even talking with customers. That would be like kind of a crazy thing to do. But there's another problem, which is people overly relying on data points without really getting the qualitative side of spending that face time. It's like, oh, I looked at, some statistics and here's what I think the statistics are telling me to do. And I think that really misses the point. You got to spend time with the customer. So how did we get from this to that? Honestly, pretty easy. You sit in a room, you open Yelp, and literally that's what we did. You open Yelp and you say, today I'm going to talk with spas and salons in San Francisco. And Yelp gives you all of their phone numbers. And you call one by one. You cold call. You talk with them. The next day, I'm going to talk with barbershops. And you talk with barbershops in San Francisco. So we kind of did that. We also, literally every place we go, we introduce ourselves and try to create conversation. We had friends that, started startups and other small businesses. And everywhere you go, those small businesses exist. That's the nice thing. It's unlike when you build enterprise software, you got to find the right buyer in the right place. Honestly, with small businesses, it's easier. It's a little bit more like consumers. They're everywhere. So we did a lot of that, a lot of repetition. I got a lot of no's from all of this. And, we were looking for, what are some huge problems? And the problem of, obviously it's really hard to start a company and build a company. One of the hardest things is anything around team and people. There's kind of two big ones. It's like money and people, right? And the people one was one that we felt is not addressed right. Because when we talked with these small businesses about the software that they use for payroll and for HR and things like that, and these are really small businesses, they felt like, this is not the right, this software was not built for me. It was built for big companies. This software is, not friendly. It's too expensive. It's hard to use. Why is it not as simple as my online bank, right? So we felt like there was a great opportunity there.
So at what point were you like, I think we got it. I think we see a pattern here. I think it's time to get going.
Right. So you're trying to build that conviction, right? When you're exploring all these ideas. And one of the ways to look at, to get conviction is look for emotions. So when the customer is super pissed off, or when the potential customer is super pissed off, or when the potential customer is super excited about something, that's where your ears need to perk up. Anything in the middle, the 90% in the middle doesn't matter. It's the top five and the bottom five that really is the signal, right? Because people are nice and they want to be nice to you. And so they're going to be, most of them are going to be kind of in the middle. Okay. So what we learned, so that's kind of a crazy story. So we had, I did like around 30 conversations at that point with people around their payroll product, the product they use for payroll. And I had two different people who mentioned to me that that their payroll provider name was ABC. I'm just going to use like a name here, not a real name, but ABC. They told me they just wanted to tell me. They felt compelled to tell me that they have their password to ABC is fuck ABC. And that was crazy because first, I didn't ask people passwords. So there may be even more than two people. And second, obviously they were upset. Obviously they felt disappointed, right? So that's where there's a huge opportunity. So that was like one of these aha moments. There was more. Like here's one, another example. There's this accountant that we knew. I knew personally. She worked in a company that I was involved with. And we just took her for lunch and say, hey, we have this idea. We want to build a new payroll product and bring it to the market focused on small businesses. And we came in, we had like a presentation, we have like this whole spiel. We wanted her to give us feedback, right? None of that happened. What did happen is the moment we opened our mouths and said we want to build a payroll product, she just started saying, stop. You need to do this. You need to do that. This is broken. That is broken. This is why I hate that product. This is why this product is broken. Da, da, da. And you kind of saw again the engagement, the excitement. So you knew like, okay, there is something here. So I remember like in those kind of days, and this is kind of all the span of a few kind of days or a couple of weeks, we kind of built up more and more and more confidence that there's something there.
So obviously the rest is history. I guess for the people that are listening, what ended up being the business model of Gusto? How do you guys make money?
Right. So we started really identifying with this pain point of payroll. And then quickly we figured out like, hey, if you solve payroll right, you already have all the employee data. You already have this important moment of employees joining a company. You have this important problem to solve around taxes and compliance. So we figured out like, payroll could be just the first out of multiple different problems that we can solve for our customers. So it ended up being this very broad platform. So today we solve, payroll, but also helping you get your company started, and also helping you, with time tracking, and helping you with benefits and compliance stuff and tax credits even, and many other things, international contractor payments and more things. And the business model is simple. There's kind of basically two revenue streams. The first one is subscription revenue. So, you gotta basically you pay every month, basically per employee per month. And then that subscription can have multiple pricing points, depends on which products that you use. And then the other, the additional revenue streams coming from commissions for our benefits business. So, in the US, small businesses often, use a small group health insurance, and that, we don't charge the customer for it, but we do get a commission because we are the brokers on this health insurance product.
So obviously Y Combinator was a pivotal experience too for you guys. And I think that obviously to Kickstarter the whole financing side of things with a very successful seed round. So why was Y Combinator so pivotal for Gusto?
Totally. Yeah. Well, YC for us was really helpful in the early days. Honestly, still today, that's one of the cool things about that. It's a community you kind of carry with you and kind of reconnect and there's all these opportunities to go and help you improve your company. But back in the early days, the thing that was really cool is that it's basically this 3 month program or like 2.5 months program, and at the end of it, there's demo day, right? So you have, back then it was like 50 companies or 55 companies, and we were one of them. And you look right and you look left and you're like, gosh, these are really smart entrepreneurs and builders and engineers. Your friends, but you're also kind of competing in the end, what investors are going to invest in. Investors are going to come into demo day and they're going to pick like 1, 2, 3 companies, whatever their budget is. There are many angel investors. You're kind of competing not for customers, but for like the quality of how much progress you made in those 2.5 months. So what ends up happening is, just figure out that you just got to go all in here. You got to bring every single, calorie that you have to the table. So in those 2.5 months, we worked super, super hard. When we started, we barely had like a line of code and we ended up, these 2.5 months with a prototype, so definitely not a full payroll product, but a prototype, and like 30 customers using the prototype. So we felt like we kind of were able in this very short time. I think we collapsed a year of work into 2.5 months by just working like crazy weekends and evenings and making a lot of quick decisions challenging ourselves to. Because if you look right and left, I always felt like we were at the bottom half. At every point of the process, I felt like, we're probably, one of the least, kind of successful companies in here. And it's not because I didn't feel good about us. It's more like I felt like, gosh, these guys are amazing.
So all in all, obviously, that propelled you guys, that allowed you to also raise a very successful seed round. So for the people that are listening to, how much capital have you guys raised to date? And what has it been the emotions of going through all the different financing cycles and expectations from investors?
Yeah, I think, so we raised over $700 million in our existence. We've been around for over 12 years. Every round is different. But where we are today is, I'm really, really proud of it. We've been profitable now for over a year. Actually quite profitable, still growing really, really well. So we're no longer in this place of like kind of needing this infusion of cash to keep the company. So that's an awesome milestone. As you go, I would say in the early days, you need to have, you raise the kind of the seed round, the A round, even the B round somewhat to build a product and kind of build that initial vision of like, hey, if we build this, we're going to have a great product market fit. And it's not just, we're building a product and you're not selling to the customer. We had customers already in seed and then series A and then series B. But then when you go more like around the series C, D and later, that's where more like a game of numbers. It's more like, okay, we should have a good product market fit. And now does go to market scale and does economic scale? Are you profitable, right? Is this going to hit a wall around profitability? So it kind of becomes less about the promise of the and the vision for the future, and more about like, okay, what have you actually done, and how does that compare with other opportunities out there, right? Which is kind of like, you know, very rational, and I think really, you know, the right way of doing things. You want kind of this Series D, E phase, you know, investors that are not just charmed by the, you know, the founders and, you know, who they are as people, although that is, I think, important because you're relying on their management to take you to the future, take the company to the future. But you want them to be very rational and look at the numbers and ask themselves and kind of look at patterns across other companies and ask, you know, is this a good business? This is going to be a great business. So, you know, the later rounds were really led by, you know, folks like T. Rowe Price and Fidelity and like some of the kind of more like, you know, private to public sort of investors. And that's kind of how our journey has looked like.
So obviously when you get investors on board, when you have over 2,700 employees like you guys have today, which is really remarkable, and being a profitable company too, that's unreal. Vision is very important, right? And they're all betting on the vision. And to that end, if I was to ask you, Tomer, if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a beautiful world where the vision of Gusto is fully realized, what does that world look like?
All right. So I wake up in this magical world. So, you know, there's a few kind of sides to our mission, and each side will paint that picture a little bit. So the first one is around peace of mind. So it's the idea of, can we help small businesses and entrepreneurs, you know, make it easier for them or give them peace of mind when they start their business and where they grow and they maintain their business. So in that future world, you know, I wake up in the morning and every person who has an idea that they're excited about, you know, that they can go out there and start their business. And obviously, you know, small, it's always going to be hard. You need to build a real business. So that doesn't go away. But you have the peace of mind that all the stuff in the back office, all the compliance stuff, all the kind of the mechanics behind the business is solved for you. So you can really focus on your product and your service. So that's the first thing. The second thing is this idea of great workplaces, you know, helping these small businesses, these medium businesses, growing businesses have great places to work. So what is a great place to work, right? It's a place where you come in and you feel valued. You feel like you're compensated correctly. You feel like, you know, your performance is evaluated correctly. You feel like you have opportunities for growth. You feel like you can have good personal relationships with other people around you. So that is, again, another part of our vision and what we're trying to do, whether it's like the all the work we're doing around benefits, making enterprise level benefits available for small businesses, or whether it's things like performance reviews and like kind of training and kind of help small businesses be a little bit more, kind of bring all the insights and professional stuff and making it easy and simple and consumable for small businesses so they can be successful as well. The last part is personal prosperity for employees. And that is like when you get paid, right? If you're the individual getting paid, get that paycheck to do more for you, right? So in cases of emergency, have access to that pay earlier if you need it. If you're, you know, if you need that, if you're saving up, have an easy way of taking that paycheck immediately and putting that into savings. We have products already around all this stuff, and it's a very promising part of Gusto. So, but yeah, it is a really big part of our vision.
So now let's talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection, because you've been pushing this for close to 13 years. I mean, 13 years in the corporate world is like 1,000 years. It's really unbelievable. No? So that's a long time. Now, let's say I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time. I bring you back in time, maybe, you know, to 2012, you know, that moment where you're in Stanford and you guys are starting to think about maybe a world where you can really bring a solution to those payroll issues that you were seeing with small businesses. And right there on the spot, you're able to have a chat with your younger self, with that younger Tomer. And you're able to give that younger self one piece of advice before launching what ended up becoming Gusto. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Yeah. I think, you know, there's a lot I would say, probably. But the thing that pops up in my mind is usually the hardest and the most important, the best parts, but also the hardest parts and the is all around people, right? Because people are they're everything, right? If you know you have a problem with your go-to-market, guess what? The right person can help you. If you have a problem with your product, guess what? The right person can help you. So it's all about people. And I think the mistakes that, you know, some of the mistakes that we made over time that were most kind of difficult and were around people as well. So I'll give you one example, and probably this is the advice I would give to myself, like you know, 10 years plus time ago, is, you know, you have this moment where the startup starts to take off, right? Things are starting to work out. You're starting to see product market fit. You got like some nice press. Like, people start to hear about you. Still very, very early on, you're still the initial team of like, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 people. And then you start like for your job, open jobs, you start seeing these amazing people applying, like amazing on paper. Like, you know, people who worked at the best companies and managed hundreds of people and, you know, did this incredible work. And you look at this and you're like, they want to work for us? That's crazy. You know, we're just this little company. So you jump on it. And, you know, maybe in the interview process, you're like, huh, this is interesting. They're talking differently and they act differently and their answers are very different than the other candidate, the other people we hired here. But, you know, what do I know? They have much bigger and better experience than I do on paper. And then sometimes those people are amazing because they do teach you a lot of things. But sometimes it doesn't work. And it doesn't work because what makes 0-1 successful is not what makes 1-N successful. And you can have someone, you have processes and, you know, kind of ways of working that are amazing to take a company from 100 million ARR to $1 billion in ARR. But if you try the same thing at 1 million ARR, it's just going to completely fail, right? So you need to bring in people. Obviously, experience is important and look into it and you can get a lot out of it. But you need to bring people who are absolutely open to do things completely differently in spite of their experience. So that's one thing I would looking back, I would advise myself.
I love that. So, Tomer, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Oh, yeah, I'm on Twitter, Tomer London. So feel free to reach out there. You know, Gusto is hiring across the board. So just check out our hiring page in gusto.com. And yeah, thank you. Thanks for this, Alejandro. This was really, really fun.
Amazing. Well, Tomer, well, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.